Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. It's nice to be back. This is my first day back from 2 weeks in Africa, in which we will do another show on talking about the poorest of the poor, people that live on $1 to $2 a day, and we provide water for them. But most of you know that, and we'll talk more on it. But today, I'm excited because we are privileged to have with us Wendy Hooper Ross, a successful real estate agent and a residential market analyst that is an expert in her field. But we are not going to talk about real estate. Today, we're going to talk about a subject that's going to affect most all of us. Wendy's story will certainly resonate with us as we discuss loss, grief, and recovery. Now, Wendy met her future husband at an industry event in 2011 and soon became incredibly close friends over the next years. They finally admitted that they were made for each other and began their romance in early 2017. Soon after, though, her husband's cancer, which had been in remission for nearly 3 years, came back and they went into a headlong battle together. It became clear in 2017 he was losing his fight, and then they were married, and 41 days later, he was gone. And Wendy writes, I lost my love and my dearest friend that day. Now a new life begins. And today we are going to talk with Wendy about loss, about grief, and about recovery. So Wendy, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie.
It's good to have you with us. You are certainly right now in the process of figuring out your next chapter, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm a work in progress.
Well, we all are work in progress, but you are...
I'm deep in it. I'm deep in reinventing my personal self, my life, my business. Everything is touched by this. You know, you're not left unscathed, and you don't, in my opinion, I don't think I'll ever be who I was before.
How's that? Who were you before and who will you become?
Rather than answer that directly, what I think of when you ask me the question is, it's like a tree in a forest that's been scorched by a forest fire. It survives the fire, you know, but decades later, if you cut that tree down, you're still going to see that dark ring where the fire had happened. I mean, it's forever changed. It just becomes part of it. And I think that this type of grief and loss or any trauma becomes part of your DNA, sort of. And it colors who you are, not necessarily positively or negatively, but it just does. And it becomes part of your nature, you know, and I think it's going to... affect my decisions and my thoughts and my feelings in some capacity forever.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant analogy of a scorched tree, and we're going to talk about that as we proceed. But I really like that because it always is a part of you. It never ceases to be a part of you. You grow, you move on, but you don't lose that part of me. We're going to talk about that more.
And yeah.
I wanted to begin the show by talking about, it's interesting how we met. That was a crazy story. We're both members at a business club called the Center Club. And I prepare all my podcasts at the club every Wednesday. So I'm there a minimum of weekly for 3 or 4 hours or longer. And after several months, I noticed that you seemed to be friends with everybody in the club. You were always talking to somebody different.
Nearly, yeah.
And so I said to myself, this must be someone that I don't know who it is. So I boldly approached you and introduced myself and asked, who the hell are you anyway?
And why does everybody know you?
And you know everybody, and you sit there and chat with them. And then you told me the story. And after your story, I knew I had to have you on the show. So here we are. And I would like to, you know, I am typically known for, I don't have soft entries. I start right into the, we start right into the nitty gritty.
All right, I'm ready.
Because that was the soft intro. Now we're sorry. Wendy, your relationship with Mick was intense, mm-hmm, and unusual, and I am curious for you to talk about the relationship, and also, most interestingly, why you decided to marry when you knew he had little time remaining, like 41
days.
Yeah,
that is the burning question. I get asked that a lot.
Of I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So tell me about your relationship first.
Well, it's, I think, grand. It was a grand relationship, and our friendship was epic. And the reason that I think our marriage was so special was because we spent so many years just being friends. We had no intention of, you know, having a romantic whatever with each other, because we truly were friends and respected that we were in different relationships with other people. So the whole artifice that comes with men and women when they meet each other and they know that they're single, and then posturing begins and you worry about how you look and what you say, there was none of that. We were completely unclouded and unaffected and very, very real. We gave each other just massive amounts of grief. You know, I was constantly giving him grief and he was constantly giving me a hard time.
About what?
Well, he started what he called the Tuesday night boys' night out with some people he used to work with because he didn't want to lose touch with them, because that's the kind of guy he was. So I started grousing, saying, well, I want to go. I want to be one of the boys. I can hang with the guys. And they said, okay. And you know, they interviewed me for their group and they liked me.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah. Yeah, I had to go through the hazing process and I became one of the boys.
The hazing process?
It was funny.
How do men haze a woman in today's society?
I think in that group, it was really more a matter of they would say things trying to shock me. And if I turned crimson or something, they would have rejected me. But I just bandied it back to them. It's like, oh, come on. You can't rock me. I'm good. I got this. I'm one of the boys.
What did you tell me at the table? Because we were using language that we don't normally use on the show, but you said you're F what?
Didn't I say I speak F too?
I speak F too because I was using the F word, and then I looked at you and I apologized. You said, no, I speak F too.
Oh, come on. I'm in real estate. I carpet bomb some days.
that's great. So your relationship really started as a friendship.
It truly
and
was.
And what was the changer? What made you?
I remember the moment. I remember the exact moment, because Mick was one of my dearest friends. He worked in a field that was related to mine. He was in real estate finance, and I sold houses, so we went together. And I was introducing a few other people that were very close friends of mine that I was shocked I had not introduced to one another. So I arranged a small get-together, really informal, over at a local restaurant bar, and said, I want you guys to come and meet each other because I adore all of you and I respect what you do professionally, and I'm remiss in that you haven't met each other. And I Freudianly, I don't know, somehow made a mistake. And when I was texting the confirmation about where to meet and what time, I included Mick on that text chain. He wasn't invited, but he was one of my closest friends, and he knew all the four other people as well. He had met them. So he came along, which was great. We're all there having our drinks, chatting. The people that were introduced to one another for the first time got along swimmingly, as I knew they would. And I sat back and I watched Mick be uncharacteristically not dude-like. And he was relaxed, didn't talk over anyone, didn't have to one-up whatever anybody had said about their accomplishments in their business, didn't have to interject anything at all. But he would quietly get up and grab an empty drink and go to the bar and refill it for them so that they wouldn't interrupt the flow of what they were doing. He just slid into this role of co-hosting this get-together with me without, I don't even think, thinking about it. It just was naturally, inherently who he was. And I sat there looking at him and admiring what he was doing. And for the first time in a very long time, I looked at him. I saw him. I looked at him as a man. And I was like, this man is beautiful and wonderful and dear and smart and a lovely human being. And he's single. What am I doing? What's the matter with me?
Yeah.
So I asked him out.
No.
I did.
Way.
I did.
Did you really?
I did.
Where did you ask him to?
Actually, that meeting that afternoon, I had to leave because I was on my way to have dinner with someone else. And as I was getting into my car, I was thinking, I don't want to go out with this clown. I want to go out with Mick. So I pulled out my phone and I texted him right then and there and said, I want to go on a date with you. And mind you, this is after, you know, 6 years of true friendship. And he texted me right back and said, you mean you want to go to dinner? And I texted back, no, I want to go on a date, all caps, with you.
And so what did you do?
Radio silence. 5 or 6 hours later, he finally texted me back and said, okay, I'm in.
No kidding. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He sounds like a very, you know, the way you're talking about him, that he didn't, wasn't trying to interject in that so much to take over in that, that conversation, that he was a very secure man.
He was so comfortable in his own skin. Yes.
That's a term we use a lot on the show, is comfortable in your own skin.
You would have liked him.
And what is it? Would I?
You would have loved him. And part of the reason that I am so well known at the club is because when Mick was well, which wasn't very long after we were together, he would come to the club with me and everyone fell in love with him. He was just one of those people. 6'4", booming Aussie voice, always laughing, always smiling, appreciated everyone and everything.
Well, isn't that typically Aussie? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just, they are so fun.
Yeah.
They're just incredible to be with.
Yeah. And I shouldn't call him Aussie. He's actually American, but he's a military brat. And because his father was a career Air Corpsman who was in Korea and then Vietnam, his mother, Mick's mother, took him and his sister to Australia where she had family so she wouldn't be alone raising them. So he was an American U.S. citizen raised in Australia. So he adopted that culture, you know, and that way of being. But then when he was 17 years old, wanted to be like dad and came back to the U.S. and enlisted in the Marines and served the U.S. as a Marine. Because he had a very strong sense of right and wrong and doing your duty and doing right for others. It was just innately who he was.
Sounds like a wonderful man.
Great guy.
Yeah, he would have been. I'm sad I didn't get an opportunity to meet him. Now let's talk about this getting married when you know that it's not going to be a lifelong marriage. I mean, well, long-lasting marriage.
Right.
You knew that he had a very short time left.
Well, there's two sides to this coin. First, one of the dear friends I mentioned to you that was in that get-together is one of my dearest friends as well, and he's a trust and probate attorney. And Mick and I had just bought a house together before we realized that he was terminally ill. And our attorney friend said, you know, you need to get married. You really do. It's going to help you so much get through the probate madness, and you're going to have enough grief to deal with that you don't. Let's minimize this as much as we can. And Mick and I talked about it, and I decided if I couldn't have him, at least I could have his name.
Yeah, and it sort of coalesced into even deepening your relationship and your commitment to one another, and that it was formalized.
Yeah. It was amazing. A dear friend of ours was at the wedding. So we decided on Tuesday, August 28th last year, that we were going to get married. We went down and got the license and everything. The next evening, the 29th, we were married at home. And
The next evening.
And the next day, so we had about 36 hours. We had told our friends, look, we're going to get married. And so the next day, friends came over and we had a ceremony that they could see and participate in, even though we had been married the day before. And a friend of Mick's live streamed our wedding on Facebook so that Mick's sister and brother-in-law and niece and cousins and whatnot around the world could see it. And so could all of our other friends who couldn't be there. I was at a dinner party last week with another attorney, dear friend of mine. She's lovely. And a friend I had met through her and haven't seen in ages came running across the room to me, threw her arms around me, and whispered in my ear, I watched you get married. It's amazing how many people were touched by that, because he was so frail by then. He had lost over 100 pounds. He was too weak to stand, so we had chairs on our back deck. And we sat there under the garlands that we had thrown up and the lights and got married in front of all of our friends. And it was barely able to speak because he had throat cancer. And after the wedding, and after we were announced as husband and wife, he stood up, and you'll have to watch this video, barely was able to croak the words out, "I am so blessed to be surrounded by friends and family who love me during the good times like this." The man was dying and couldn't help but describe that day as a good day.
He must have loved you deeply.
He did.
Yeah, that is...
I think having 41 days of a marriage like that is better than having 40 years of a bad one.
Oh my goodness, are you kidding? 40 years of a bad one is...
That would be hell.
That is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and 41 years of marriage is difficult. You know, you're going to have your wonderful times as you mm-hmm. and Mick had, and you're going to have your times of, you know, conflict, which is can be years,
right,
you know, after 40 years.
But I was a little bit lucky. We didn't have time to argue. I got off easy on that one. But you know, obviously there was difficulty. I mean, he became so ill, and just watching someone that you love suffer, you know, because it was in his throat, so he could no longer swallow. So he had a feeding tube installed in his stomach, and all of his meds had to go in there. And the cancer was going up into his brain, and we figured it was messing with his nerve receptors, so we couldn't manage his pain. So even when he became inarticulate and he couldn't speak anymore and he couldn't communicate with me anymore, you could see his face. You could see him writhing in pain, and 41 days was enough.
You must have been such a great pleasure for him for his final days to be married to you and have someone that he's loved, that he loves and that loves him in those final things. That's quite admirable.
It taught me about how I want to be when I pass. I mean, obviously we're all dying. We're all going to die. And I hadn't spent any time really thinking about what I wanted that to look like. And I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about what it needed to look like for Mick. I was too busy being in it. And thank goodness, as I look back, I don't have regrets. And I feel like I did the best I possibly could. And I do think he had what he most wanted. And it wasn't just me. It was the dog. Oh, my gosh. He may have married me for my dog. He loves that dog. And that dog loves him. You know, but there are many times when he was no longer conscious or coherent, but he would reach his hand out and he would grab the dog's paw and he would hold the dog's paw and the dog would just lay there with him.
Oh, my goodness.
I've got photos that will just make your heart ache.
Well, the story makes my heart ache. But I'm really impressed with you, and to give a gift to Mick and him being able to return that gift, even though he was limited in what he could do,
mm-hmm.
that he could return that gift. And so those are just a magical 41 days until
mm-hmm.
I'm sure it just got almost unbearable.
It was no fun. It was no, and I know I scared a few people. there was some petite little nurses that are probably still cursing my name because I was a bit of a pit bull.
Were you?
I was a bit of a pit bull. There was one time around midnight, because I was up every hour dosing him or supervising his dosing of medications and things, and one of the nurses didn't give him enough morphine, and he started writhing in pain. And when a 6'4" body starts thrashing around in bed, they end up on the floor, you know. So I was trying to control him, and I was screaming at her. And I'm sure I've probably scarred her for life. Might be some PTSD.
Scarred her for life. I doubt that. You're too kind. I can't. You know, you might have been tough, but you're too kind to be someone that would scar someone for life.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
I have about a year ago. I came across the writings and public speaking she's done, TED Talks, of Pauline Boss. And I want to read to you an extended quote, and on radio, extended quotes are always very difficult, so I will keep them short. I was just trying to figure out how to turn off the sound on my computer. And Pauline Boss came up with a concept that's called ambiguous loss. And it's really, you know, we chatted very briefly this afternoon about it, and I think it's utterly profound, and I really want your take on it. And it is written of her that through her writings and public speaking, family therapist and professor Pauline Boss, whose book is titled Ambiguous Loss, speaks boldly on the myth of closure. Mm-hmm. And that is so anti-American. Well, you know.
It's just to hell with it.
Exactly. You know, we're always talking about closure, but it's like your tree.
Mm-hmm.
See, your tree is still going to have that dark ring around it when it was burned.
Right.
And so it doesn't get closure on it, but it's nevertheless keeps growing.
Right.
You know, I think if you're so devastated by it that it completely stops your life, then you need help. You
right.
know, then you need group help, perhaps therapy, other friends, finding things to do, but you have not faced that. But anyway, back on this quote, the myth of closure, of Professor Boss, it is written, Pauline Boss created the field of ambiguous loss, that is, loss without closure. I like ambiguous loss. Mm-hmm. It's a great word. And grief is complicated, she writes, such as dealing with parents, divorce, addiction, dementia, aging, and death. And she writes, you love somebody, and when they're lost, you still care about them. You just can't turn it off. You
right.
just can't turn off that
right.
love. And she goes on and says, there is no such thing as closure. And I know right now I can hear the thoughts of our audience saying, what are you talking about? Everybody talks about closure. That how do you get closure on it? And she says that closure is a myth that we need to put aside, like such as the idea of accepting that grief has five linear stages, and then when you pass through these stages, you come out on the other side of it, and there's no more grief, no more loss, and that's just bullshit.
You know? I agree.
That's just not true in life, and so therefore she coined the term ambiguous loss, creating a new field in family therapy and psychology. She has wisdom for the complicated griefs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she uses nice little phrases.
She does.
You know, the complicated griefs and losses in all our lives and for how we can best approach the losses of others. So tell me, what do you think about the myth of closure, about closure and going through your five stages? I think it's important to go through the stages of grief.
I have many opinions about this. Something that I knew with myself, that I now know about myself, is that I had no alternative but to go through the stages and to give myself time. I had no alternative. I was not capable of resuming normal activity for a time. I had to go through a bit of, you know, catatonia. You know, I found myself walking around the house in my pajamas for hours. You know, you have to go through the stages and allow yourself time to heal, and who knows how much time that's going to take. I'm not going to presume to tell anyone else how long their grief should take. And I would imagine there are probably many people who are wondering why I was grieving someone I was married to so briefly. And to hell with them.
Yeah, but you had such a long relationship.
We
You married to...
I married my best friend.
Yeah.
Anyway... So having said that, you know, I do think there are stages, and I think that they probably are a little bit different for everybody. And I do think we have to be kind to ourselves and give ourselves permission to be someone that we're not used to being for a while. And in my case, I've always been an overachiever, a high achiever, and, you know, I like going out there and setting the world on fire. And I took a year off to be with Mick when he was ill.
Right.
And then, so it was about 6 months with Mick when he was ill. And then it was about another 6 months after he passed, just to give myself time to be human again. I was in grief, you know, and that's okay. And I think I think my biggest message, if any, to share with people is that it is okay to be a mess. It is okay. And I do not believe I will ever revert to whoever I was before. I'm that tree. I've been burned. I've been scarred. And the pain that I felt was the deepest pain I've ever felt in, of course, in my world. But I think, like all things, that pendulum now swings so much farther the other's way too. I think my capacity for love and my appreciation of love is that much greater as well. The last days with Mick, if I would lay with him on the bed and he would hold my hand and he would squeeze it and I would know, oh, he's aware I'm still here, that brought such profound joy. And those little moments taught me to really pay attention and focus and understand every single moment of every day has incredible beauty and value. And I don't know that I would have gotten that were it not for the grief part.
Yeah, you know what? I want to continue on with the thought of the opportunity for growth from suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And that how, you know, Nietzsche wrote how strong and how influential and powerful suffering was, and mm-hmm. that we really can't have a great life without it. And we're going to take a brief break, and then we're going to come back and chat more about that.
Great.
Hi there, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And today, my pleasure is to be chatting with Wendy Hooper Ross, who, as she has just explained, has a most unusual marriage situation. At the death of her husband was quite a time of grief and quite a time of suffering, and it took you a year. I know I'm adopted, and when my adoptive mother, she was God in my life. She, you know, I was raised in a matriarchal family, and she was everything. And she died when I was 40 years old, and it took me a full year.
Sure.
It took me a full year because she was so influential. Her power over me. A power over not controlling me, but teaching me the important things of life was just overwhelming. So I understand, and I'm not sure everybody completely understands the value of grief and suffering,
mm-hmm.
and that we cannot grow without it.
Right.
It is something that is heart changing. And life-changing. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Through suffering and through pain comes growth. I mean, you know, if we get too comfortable, we stop growing. And I'm not saying that I'm delighted this happened. Of course I'm not.
No, but, never.
Yeah, but I do feel like I am bigger because of it. Emotionally and spiritually and in all ways, I am heightened because of having had that experience.
Yeah, you see life through a whole different filter.
I do.
Yeah, you mentioned. What did you mention that I wanted to talk about? Oh, that you were talking. You know, today mindfulness and presence are. Hmm. You know, that's those are the go-to words. You know,
buzzwords.
To be mindful and present, but. After Mick's death and your experience of grief mm-hmm. and suffering, the way you discussed it earlier was that you are more mindful and more present and in your life. How is that possible? What impact do you think your relationship with Mick and his death brought about that?
You know, I think just... Here's an example, and I think I shared this with you before. I would always say to Mick when we were friends, you know, life is lived in the small moments. And I believed it. And then when I had those last few precious moments with Mick, I better understood my own words. It was like, you know, it was crazy because I thought, wow, I understood what the words meant, but I didn't really get them. I mean, on a soul level, I understood, oh my God, life is lived in the small moments. And if we get so busy on our treadmill of life that we stop paying attention to the moments, we're going to miss all the good stuff. And I find myself sitting back, like the day that I met you, and just sort of wallowing in the joy of conversation with people whom I like. And when you came up and said, who are you? I thought, what a brave man. I should probably know this guy.
That was, I don't normally do that. I don't normally approach women and say, who are you?
Who are you? But to your point, I think in my life and in my business, it has allowed me or caused me to be a little bit more aware of everything, myself and others. You know, I make fewer snap judgments. I really, really meditate on things, especially I'm in real estate. People get very emotionally charged in real estate transactions.
Right.
I find
right.
myself being much more careful about what I say and how I say it to make the outcome better for everybody. I for some reason, it's taught me, I think, a greater degree of patience.
Patience and yeah, that I you know, going back a bit on what you said, I so agree that life is composed of small moments,
right.
And that we must take advantage of those moments and appreciate what we're doing. Even our conversation now, you know, I'm in a learning process of, you know, that's why I love to do interviews, because I'm interested in other people and I want to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And this tragedy has seemed to have impacted you just to the highest degree of living a better life and maybe realizing that life is short.
Yeah, I think it drove that point home ferociously. Life is short and every day is a gift. And if I don't appreciate that I have today, I'm probably screwing up because I'm not guaranteed tomorrow. It enhanced all of that awareness. Something that surprised me, though, I think my greatest shock, is that I've always been a hardworking, independent woman. And I always thought, you know, I don't have a man in my life because I need one. I have one in my life because I want one. And that is true. But after having Mick and losing Mick, I realized I really want a partner. That is important to me in life. It's more important than I knew. So, little epiphany.
Yeah, that's not a little epiphany. That's great. Tell me, I'm always curious about mindfulness and presence. You know, I never take things at face value. I'm always contemplating that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering in a practical way, how are you? When do you find time to be mindful? Are you when you walk in, say, to the Center Club,
mm-hmm.
and you're very present, you're seeing people, is there any way that you're thinking at the time, I have to be this, or is it just a natural
outcome? It feels like a natural outcome, because it's not deliberate. It becomes deliberate if I find myself drifting off. Like if I was here having a conversation with you and all of a sudden I'm thinking, oh, did I let the dog out or did I mail the tax check? Or then I snap myself back and think, what are you doing? You're here with Charlie. You're speaking with Charlie. Focus. So those are the only times where anything becomes deliberate. But I don't walk in and think, okay, with, you know, a deliberateness, I'm going to do these things and pay attention to those things. It's just happening.
I love that word deliberate. I use the word intentional, but I love the word deliberate, that we need to live. It is, well, let me take that back. That sounds awful preachy. it is most advantageous to live life intentionally,
mm-hmm.
or with purpose and with paying attention, just
mm-hmm.
simply paying attention.
It's
that I've often heard of the most popular people or the most admired people are the ones, when they're talking to you, you're the only person that exists.
Right.
There's nobody else in the room, nobody else around, but I'm talking to you. And, and you said that in our interview, that, you know, other thoughts, because other thoughts come to mind, but it's like a woman that I once heard in a lecture that talked, who lived in Spain, and the part that she lived, when you ate, there were a lot of flies. And so you could spend all your time shushing flies, or just accept the fact that there's going to be flies, and just keep eating. And don't worry about it. If one's on a piece of your meat, you know, you push it off, and, you know, because you try not to eat the fly.
But ideally,
you probably do have some fly innards in you. But it is, that is the art of avoiding distraction.
Right. Exactly. And I think that, Charlie, is why I'm well liked at the club, because I really do give a damn about how so-and-so's day was. I really do care if their son's broken arm is mending and he's back in sports. I really do care, because I know it matters to them. And, you know, it makes you wildly popular. It's a fascinating thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have a similar story. My friend who is on the show often, Terry Hershey, and so the listeners will know of Terry Hershey, the woman he's with right now just got out of surgery for breast cancer.
Oh, wow.
And they removed lymph nodes, and they've taken all the tests, and it looks like she's completely okay.
Great.
But I call him a couple days a week and tell me, and just to say, tell me, how's Nancy doing? You know, how is she feeling? What's happening? And I think he's shocked by that
probably
someone would actually just call. And, you know, he and I are such close friends, we're going to BS, but that's always the first question. It's, tell me about Nancy. How is she doing? And I think the more we do that, the more important we make other people feel.
Everybody is important.
Everybody is important. One of my goals in life, Wendy, is to help people feel better about themselves.
It's a great goal.
To like themselves more.
It's a great goal.
Because who's doing that? If I don't do that, who's going to do that? Because we're also self-centered, that we only want to think of ourselves in our, you know, the show's going to... People on the show are probably wondering why I always talk about it, but the American dream drives us not to be social, except for monetary gain.
Right, and this dogged pursuit of A, B, and C.
Yes, yes, and we don't get a chance to enjoy this life, and it never ceases, as I read on death, and it never ceases to impress me that very, very successful people, when they write about the importance of their life, they will talk about relationships.
Oh, yeah.
It's always about that.
It begins and ends with love.
So my final question for you as we begin to wrap up the show. So it's feeling like, what's he going to ask me now?
Exactly.
Yeah. No, my question is, so what now? What are your intentions for life after loss? I know you've explained how it's impacted you, but now intentionally, what do you have you changed your intentions of how you want to live your life?
A bit.
And what do you want to do?
A bit. I have always been that workaholic person that was doggedly pursuing, you know, the accomplishments and not really the stuff, but I'm very competitive. I just have to win. And so I didn't have as much time. I didn't dedicate as much time to my sister and my nieces and my great nieces and my great nephews. And that has become more important to me, which is, I think, a big lesson that I've learned. It's like, I'm not going to be around forever. They're not going to be around forever. I need to pay attention. And I spend more time doing what I darn well want to do. And I spend less time doing that which I don't. And with people I don't. And that has been transformative. There are people I've just edited out of my life. I'm like, you know what? I don't want to hang out with them. I'm not going to.
Yeah. It reminds me of a book I just ordered from Derek Silvers.
Yeah.
And it's titled, It's Either Hell Yes or No.
Right.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
It's either hell yes, I'm full in, or
right.
No, I'm not in at all.
Right.
I'm just in for the fun of it.
I'm not going to waste a moment in conversation or in any occupation that doesn't bring me or someone else joy or satisfaction. I'm just not going to do it. In fact, I had a conversation. I wish you had been there to see it. I was extremely pointed with someone at the club last week. And I was having a conversation with a woman about a gentleman that I've started dating, because, yes, I'm dating again. And she was concerned this person wasn't good enough for me, which is what good friends always say. And this person who barely knew me came up and started just trash-talking the guy. And I uninvited him from our conversation. And he didn't take a hint. And so I very bluntly said, get the hell away from me. This conversation is over.
Did you really?
Absolutely. So I'm not all sunshine and roses all the time.
Oh, no, I so admire that. That is so healthy, because what value is he adding to your life and to your conversation?
And I wasn't going to patiently wait for him to continue being an ass. He could go be an ass somewhere else, not with me.
That is great, and I think we're going to close on that note because I like that note, you know. Hell yes or no. And if it's no, and it's destructive no, then get the hell away from me.
Bravo.
I don't need you. Mm. Great insight, Wendy. Great insight. So, Wendy Hooper-Ross, thank you so much for spending time with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, it was fun. It was just, and so, what is the word I'm thinking of? So serendipitous. You know, that I would meet you at the club and we get to do this. And I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And be sure to check us out on our website, thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie right here on Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.